repeat maybe a minute? Okay. Good morning and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Justice Sue Walker and Justice Lee Gabriel and I are your panel this morning. And we have one case on the 1030 docket. It is Parsons versus Lisa Blue is executrix of Baron and Butt. If counsel is ready, I'll ask the clerk to call the case and announce the lawyers who are going to argue.
Court calls Roger K. Parsons versus Lisa A. Blue Baron.
Mr. Nygaard, are you ready to begin?
Yes, ma'am.
May it please the court. Right, first off, I think we have we still have a bone of contention over what amended response is in play. I brought it with me today. This is the amended response from the sister case that the court's order gave me permission to cite to for purposes of the Parsons case. Let me just say that in the trial transcript, it shows that the judge recognizes that this Parsons amended response, his first amended response, was timely filed. Moreover, I have three exhibits attached to my reply brief that demonstrate that are evidence that demonstrate that the brief was sent on time and received within the 10 days that are stipulated in TRCP 5. If you mail something on the deadline, if it arrives at the court within 10 days, it's considered timely filed. But of course, even without considering the evidence, which arguably is outside the record, the trial judge does say on the record that the amended response that was filed with affidavits 7 days ago, I mean, she stipulates that it was filed 7 days in advance of trial. So I don't think it's much of a bone of contention, but I just wanted to look at that to start with.
And which file is the first amended response in?
Oh, when I motioned to append the record, I motioned that it be appended from the Matzenbacher and Greenberg and DuPont case, and the judge the order was, well, why don't you just cross reference it instead of?
We can take judicial notice.
Yeah, judicial notice. So. So having cleared that up, I'd like to move on with the first two points of error that we point out in our reply brief. I did make a motion that the court consider our reply brief points of error. I mean, I do know that usually you cannot raise a point of error in a reply brief. However, in this case, my point of error is part and parcel of a counter argument to an argument raised in the appellee's brief, their response brief, and I can rehash the motion, or
we're carrying the motion. We haven't acted on the motion.
Oh, okay. With regard to that. In the appellee's brief, they state that the only responses before the court are the original response and the fourth amended petition. The original response was filed by my client 2 months before in a situation of great haste in reply to the Baron and Bud motion for summary judgment. And over the course of a couple of months, he... by the way, that first response to the Barron and Budd motion for summary judgment is quite thin. It's between 20 and 30 pages. Okay, and it also includes, in addition to the 20 or 30 pages, it includes a motion for more time. Things were put off, and rather than have the hearing at the time it was scheduled, it was put off, and the judge scheduled it so that the Barron and Budd motion would be heard on the same day as the other defendants in that case, the same day as the Greenberg motion, the Motzenbacher motion, the DuPont motion.
I'm sorry, are you saying that the motion for continuance was granted?
No. It when you read the trial transcript, the judge just decides not to have the hearing that day. And it's there's some miscommunication. There's the fact that Roger Parsons' mail carrier went bankrupt, and there was a corresponding failure to serve him in the other cases. And I gather that it was just the judge's decision that it would be a lot easier just to hold to hear all those summary judgment motions on the same day.
Okay, so how long was it put off?
Well, the summary judgment, eventually it was held on July 23rd. The original motion was filed on May 29th. So, to the best of my recollection, it's right around June 6th would have been the originally scheduled hearing. But again, there was no hearing. And to better answer your question, Your Honor, it does seem to be a de facto continuance of a sort. But I'm not sure that you could say that it's in response to my client's motion for a continuance. Maybe it is. Maybe that's one of the factors the judge considered. But what I can say is that the judge elected to have that hearing with the other defendants' hearing all on the same day, July 23rd. So when in their appellee's brief, the appellees argue that the judge only considered the first response to the summary judgment motion and the fourth amended petition, they base their argument on timeliness. And again, as I said earlier, not only do we have evidence that Roger Parsons filed his amended response 7 days in advance of trial as required by TRCP 166A, the judge also stipulates that it was timely. She recognizes that the brief was timely. And that essentially lays the ground for my reply brief point of error. Because, they're saying that the judge considered the original response, and I'm saying that, and that gives me a platform to counter-argue that she didn't, that the amended response was before her as a matter of law, and that if she did, in fact, fail to consider it, then that's clear error. Because for a number of reasons I'll develop. But
the bottom line is, regardless of what summary judgment evidence is considered, what summary judgment evidence is there, considering any and all evidence in the record, that Barron and Budd owed any duty to Parsons?
Of course. I argue that in my appellant's brief that essentially we're looking at pre-2005 Texas here, and I know that the situation is now, it's such that when I refer a client to another lawyer, and I did so just the other day, if I just send that client to the other lawyer, that doesn't entitle me to any compensation from that client. I can't cut a deal with that lawyer because of the way the disciplinary rules have been restructured post-2005. Now, in this case, we're looking back in the 1990s, and it was a recognized practice of referral that when you simply by referring someone to another firm, that essentially gives you the right to contract with that firm to which you referred that client for a referral fee. Now,
do you have any case law that says that makes you the, if you make the referral, that makes you the attorney for that client along with the attorney to whom the client is referred? Because I think the task force in the 2005, for the 2005 changes, makes several comments that does not create financial responsibility on the part of the referring lawyer, even after 2005. I'm sorry, I followed my question with the comment. Does referring someone to a lawyer make the referring lawyer also a lawyer for the client?
In this case, it does. And the argument I make is based on contract. Okay? And now, I think in the middle of that summary judgment hearing, somebody made a comment that if I recommend a truck to somebody, that there's no resultant contract. I mean, I recommended you should get a Silverado, and you got the Silverado, and it wasn't big enough to pull your camper, and don't come crying to me. That was a gratuitous type recommendation on my part. But what we're looking at here is a little different because in this particular case, again, we're talking pre 2005 law. And Barron & Budd itself, Westlaw shows that they've been involved in the same kind of referral back and forth lawsuits where they're being sued to provide compensation post referral. But in this case, we have an additional item that I think gets us past what you might see as an obstacle to a contract being formed here. And that addition is that the gentleman to whom Barron & Budd referred Roger Parsons was Barron & Budd's own lawyer. Now, and that essentially gives a second means of consideration, which consideration is the reason that my recommendation that you go out and buy a Silverado is not a contract. Because there's no consideration in there. If you were able to somehow work consideration into that deal, into my recommendation that you go buy a truck, then I would assume that we would have a contract.
What is Barron & Budd offering that's been accepted to form this contract?
When Roger Parsons makes his request for a referral, and Barron & Budd performs by providing that referral, that's the foundation for your contract.
Do you have any evidence of consideration at all of any money paid to Barron & Budd by your client?
here's the situation on that. Oh, let me just answer your question. No, not directly from my client. But can I develop that, please? Okay. In the summary judgment evidence that Barron and Budd provided en route to its summary judgment motion, they have a couple of affidavits that state that Greenberg was involved, was handling several unrelated suits for Barron and Budd. And when you boil that down, when you strip away those adjectives, you see one statement, that Greenberg worked for Barron and Budd. And another affidavit, I've shown that Greenberg is an aging lawyer. I mean, it's pretty easy to see that from the facts that that it's very easy to understand that he actually did only work for Barron and Budd. And if the obvious thing to do in this situation, if you're trying to counter my client's claim of respondeat superior, is to say, hey, Greenberg's an independent attorney. He's got this job with these guys in Fort Worth. He's got this job over here in Odessa. But they didn't do that. All they did was say, these jobs that he's doing for Greenberg aren't related to one another. Now, when Barron and Budd refers my client to Greenberg and my client pays Greenberg and Greenberg is only working for Greenberg, that's a benefit. That's a benefit of goodwill that Barron and Budd is receiving in this transaction. And it supports this contract. And it's only one thing that supports the contract. You'll see in my appellant's brief that I also argue for consideration to a third party. That's another route to consideration under Texas law. But and I understand your question. My client did not write a check to Barron and Budd, but Barron and Budd benefited tremendously from this because if I'm working for someone and they throw business my way of this magnitude, that's going to solidify my relationship with them. It's going to enable me to continue working for them at whatever fee I was working for them. It's going to it just makes everything a lot much more convenient. And
it might be a really good deal, but that doesn't mean that there's a contract or that there's a duty owed. I mean, there's a lot of firms that have only one or two clients.
Understood, but the nature of the service provided is a service that only an attorney can provide.
But the service was just a referral. The service was that Barron and Budd did was just to refer a client to another firm. And sure, it might be really great that this other, or to Greenberg, that made this referral to Greenberg, and it might be really great for Greenberg that he got that referral, and it might be really great for him that he gets to do a lot of work for Barron and Budd, but I'm still not seeing how that creates a contract between Barron and Budd and the client.
Well, yes, ma'am?
A minute ago you said something about, and I saw this in the briefs, I think, Greenberg working for Barron and Budd, I think. Are you making an argument that Greenberg was a captive counsel, kind of like a captive firm sometimes is of an insurance company?
That's actually pled in my client's petition.
Okay. And do you have evidence that is true, that is a fact? I mean, you have evidence in the record that is a fact, that he only worked for Barron and Budd?
The evidence I have is my client's pleading and defendants and appellee's response that the work he did was disparate and unrelated jobs. My client's personal knowledge of Greenberg and the work he's doing for Barron and Budd is the basis for the original allegation. And of course, if my client were incorrect in his allegation, of the easy way to say, well, no, he doesn't just work for Barron and Budd, is to say that he doesn't just work for Barron and Budd. So admittedly, the evidence of my client's personal experience and his knowledge of Greenberg might not be the best evidence, but it is the only evidence, and joined with Barron and Budd's statement that the work that Greenberg did for Barron and Budd is disparate and unrelated, essentially ices the statement that there isn't any counterposing evidence.
May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Lamandola, and I am the attorney for the appellees, Lisa Blue, the executrix of the estate, and Barron and Budd. While I think that the legal issues presented in this case are relatively straightforward, before I address the substantive issues, I'd like to talk about the record, because I think there is some confusion in the record. And I know that there was some confusion on my part as I was preparing my briefs, in part because of the serial filings that were done and what was contained in the record as I originally looked at it. Now, I have prepared a handout, which you should have in front of you. I provided a copy to Mr. Nygaard earlier this morning. That may help us kind of walk through that quickly. What I want to address is what was before the trial court at the time that it considered and granted the motion for summary judgment. All right. And what you'll see is the Fourth Amended petition. Now, my understanding is that Mr. Parsons did file a Fifth Amended petition prior to the motion for summary judgment, as well as a motion for leave to file a Sixth Amended petition. But we know that those pleadings were not before the court, or at least considered by the court in connection with the motion for summary judgment, based on the court's rulings. And there is a
copy?
I'm sorry?
Do you have another copy?
Yes, ma'am, I do. May I approach to hand it to you, or should I? Does everybody have a copy? With regards to the Fifth Amendment petition, you'll see there's an order in Volume 9 of the Supplemental Clerk's Record at pages 1860 to 61, where the Fifth Amendment petition was struck with regards to Barron and Budd's, any allegations against Barron and Budd. I believe that petition was filed in response to special exceptions by a co-defendant, Conoco DuPont, and it was limited. The amendment was only supposed to be limited to allegations against them. It was not, and that's why the court struck any additional allegations with regards to Barron and Budd. The Sixth Amended petition, there was a motion for leave to file on the day of the summary judgment hearing, but the court denied that, and you'll find the order denying leave to file the Sixth Amended petition in Volume 5 of the Supplemental Clerk's Record, I believe at page 1036. We also know from looking at the court's rulings on the objections to the summary judgment evidence that the petitions themselves, which were attached as evidence to one of his responses to the motion for summary judgment, were struck. And if you look at the appellee's appendix, I believe that's at tab 6, but it's also in the clerk's record, you'll see the objections to the summary judgment where the court specifically ruled that they were not evidence to be considered in connection with the summary judgment. So what is the live pleading? The live pleading is the Fourth Amended petition. With regards to what is the live response, and I have to apologize because in my initial responsive brief, I was under the mistaken impression that it was the original response filed on, May 29th, to which there were those three exhibits which Mr. Nygaard just talked about. There was an affidavit from Mr. Parsons dated 5/29, some deposition excerpts, and then the motion for continuance. A week prior to the summary judgment hearing, there was an amended response that was filed, and that had five exhibits attached to it. Those were the first two were the same, that I think it's the 9-page affidavit dated 5/29, the deposition excerpt. But Exhibit 3 had changed, and Exhibit 3 was now Mr. Parsons' response to a 2007 motion for summary judgment filed by a co-defendant, the Motzenbachers, and it had a voluminous set of attachments to it, several hundred pages. And then Exhibits 4 and 5 were the amended petitions, 5 and 6. Now, how do we know that this is the response that the court considered? We can tell, again, by looking at the court's rulings on the summary judgment evidence, because the court specifically addressed that Exhibit 3. It struck it because of its voluminous nature, because Parsons had not specifically alluded to anything in the record in Exhibit 3 or cited to it. But it also specifically ruled on some of those attachments. There were letters and unsigned affidavits and reports by various individuals. And you'll see when you look at that order, you can see that the court specifically addressed it. So that's how we know that was the response that the court considered. So we're in agreement with Mr. Nygaard and Parsons that that's the response of pleading. There is a second amended response that was filed the day before, and in my brief I set forth why that was not considered. It was untimely. There was no motion for leave. There is a 17-page affidavit attached to that motion, but again, that's untimely. I have to apologize because, again, when I looked at the initial record, I thought it was the original response. It's that amended response. The amended response doesn't appear anywhere in the record currently. It may be in this where he's appended the record or where there's been authorization for that. But what I did is I have sent a letter to the clerk asking the clerk to prepare yet another supplemental record, which contains specifically that amended response. So it will be before you when you are considering this. Last and not least, when you look at the reporter's record, you'll see a reference to an 18-page affidavit, which is separate and apart from the 17-page affidavit attached to the second amended response. That 18-page affidavit isn't included in any of these responses. Instead, that was attached to Parsons' response to Greenberg's motion for summary judgment. And I can't tell from looking at it whether that was timely filed or not. But I do know that Greenberg's, that response is in the record, in the supplemental clerk's record. You'll find it there. And I know that trial counsel objected to that affidavit. That may raise the issue of, you know, there was a question about does it actually have to be attached to the response of pleading. I'm certainly not here to argue for some formalistic approach to Rule 166 where, you know, you have to actually physically staple it to it, particularly given that we e-file and things have changed. And I know that there's some law in Dallas that says as long as it's filed and served, that's okay. But I do believe that if you are going to rely on evidence, that the court should require that be brought before the court. And that, particularly in a multi-party case, if you're filing a response to a separate code, a separate response to a separate defendant's motion for summary judgment, to then say, well, there's evidence there that you should consider in connection with my response to the summary judgment that this defendant has filed, that you should bring that before the court. So, again, just to be clear, Fourth Amended petition, First Amended response. But regardless of whether you engage in this technical analysis of what evidence was before the court, or you just move to the substantive issues of law, you still end up at the same place, which is that Barron and Budd was entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law. And the first inquiry there is there a duty? You can't sue an attorney for malpractice unless there's an attorney-client relationship there. And there's no evidence anywhere in the record that there was an agreement, a written agreement, or even an explicit oral agreement that Fred Barron said to Mr. Parsons, I'll be your lawyer. Barron and Budd didn't appear in any of the underlying proceedings. They didn't sign any of the pleadings. There's no evidence that they ever met with any of the lawyers to discuss strategy or how the case would proceed. Instead, what Parsons has argued, what the appellants are arguing, is that you should imply an attorney-client relationship based on an implied oral contract. And certainly there are cases where even this court has said, you know, we're gonna infer that there was an attorney-client relationship here. But again, that's looking at it based on an objective standard, based on the conduct of both parties. And here, there's no evidence that Fred Barron did anything or Barron and Budd did anything that would give rise to a reasonable person believing that there would be an attorney-client relationship between the two of them. It's not sufficient to say, I thought this person was my lawyer. There has to be some objective evidence, and the record is completely devoid of that. Not just from the standpoint of it wasn't included in your record. The record before the trial court, there was no evidence produced in response to the motion for summary judgment that indicated that Barron and Budd had any relationship other than apparently Mr. Barron had lunch with Mr. Parsons following an argument at the Fifth Circuit on some unrelated case. Likewise, Parsons has argued that Greenberg, he's an agent, or maybe Barron and Budd should be held responsible under principles of respondeat superior. And again, the record is completely devoid of that. In fact, if you look at Barron and Budd's motion for summary judgment, there are two affidavits, an affidavit from Lance Poole, the executive director of the firm, and an affidavit from Mr. Greenberg himself, where they both of the affidavits essentially track each other and say, Barron and Budd says, Mr. Greenberg's not a member of the firm. He has represented us in separate, unrelated litigation, but we've never conferred with him about the Parsons case. He's a separate and independent lawyer, and Greenberg says the same thing. To argue that because I had lunch with somebody and they were to ask me, I mean, I'm actually reminded of like in the context of like estate planning. I mean, as an attorney, people ask me all the time, do you have a will? Who prepared your will? If me saying so-and-so at such-and-such a firm prepared my will and they did a good job is sufficient to impose an attorney-client relationship, then we're going to radically alter the current landscape of the law with regards to attorney-client relations. And I know, like, specifically in that context, I'm thinking of the Morin case, Morin versus Vinson and Elkins, where it was in the same kind of context, estate planning. There the court found that there was an attorney-client relationship, but it was more than just, hey, this is who I used to prepare my will. In that case, those lawyers met with the beneficiaries. They sent them letters. They provided them tax advice. They were involved in a way where, again, there was objective evidence from which the court could, a reasonable person could, infer that there was an attorney-client relationship. So we say as a threshold matter, summary judgment was proper because there was no duty, no attorney-client relationship. But even separate and apart from that, there's other deficiencies in a claim for malpractice. There's no expert testimony that was produced that would indicate that there was a breach of whatever the appropriate standard of care was, or that there was any causal relationship, any proximate cause between any act or omission of Barron and Budd and the injuries alleged to have been sustained by Mr. Parsons. And I understand from looking at the pleadings that really what the injury is that he claims is that he didn't get an award of punitive damages in an underlying wrongful death case that was tried and went up on appeal. And I know that this issue may have been considered in a separate appeal, I think by this court and also by the Fifth Circuit. So, again, he's tried to manufacture a lot of other claims by fracturing his cause of action. Again, we addressed this in our brief. But when you look at the crux of his complaint, it is actually the failure to provide any legal services at all. Parsons never says, Barron and Budd did this and this was wrong. Barron and Budd did this and this was wrong. What they say is, Barron and Budd didn't do anything other than refer me to Bob Greenberg, who they alleged malpracticed. And I would think that if that's the nature of your claim, that you would have to show what the standards are for referral. You know, I hate this referral argument. We talk about it kind of casually. Well, he referred them. And in the legal context, referral has a specific meaning. And I think that Parsons has tried to back into that. You know, in any case that I've seen where an attorney has made a referral to another attorney, there's a pre-existing attorney-client relationship between that lawyer and the client that they're referring. And here, as a preliminary matter, there hasn't been that showing made. So, again, we would argue there's no duty, and as a result, there's no basis for imposing liability on Barron and Budd, and there's nothing in the record that creates a genuine issue of material fact regarding this. So summary judgment is proper. I will just briefly address the other two points that are before the court on appeal. One deals with some evidentiary issues. Parsons has objected to the affidavit of Lance Poole. I point out to the court that there were no objections that were made at the time of summary judgment, and that if he had a problem with the form of that affidavit, that's an objection that you have to raise in the trial court. It hasn't been preserved at all. But more importantly, not just with that affidavit, but with the problems that he says the court erred in striking some evidence, there's been no showing, at least in the briefing, that the court abused its discretion in making those evidentiary rulings. And that same standard, which applies to Judge Walker's decision in denying the motion to disqualify, which we haven't talked about, but I will say that I have a difficult time in reading the brief and then understanding exactly what was the basis for the motion to disqualify Judge Wilkinson. But there's been no showing that Judge Walker acted in an unreasonable or arbitrary manner, that he abused his discretion, that his decision had no relationship to any rule or guiding principle. And as a result, again, I believe that this court should affirm the trial court's rulings in all respects. And unless there's any specific issues either in the record or with regards to our legal arguments, I'll sit down now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Nygaard, do you have rebuttal?
I'd like to address some of the evidence that was struck for a moment and then segue from that into what I've pled in what I've argued in the appellant's brief as a failure to inform my client of non-representation. The trial judge, when she goes through and checks off on the order striking some of my client's evidence, some of the evidence with regard to what Greenberg and Motzenbacher told my client regarding Barron and Budd is struck, and it's struck on, I believe, on the grounds of hearsay. And in this particular case, when my client says that Greenberg and Motzenbacher told him that Barron and Budd was in good with Judge Richter, and so that it's in the bag, not to worry, we're in like Flynn, or when Greenberg and Motzenbacher tell my client that he should hire the investigator that works for Barron and Budd, or that Barron and Budd is cooperating on this case, those are not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. They are offered for their impact on my client. Even if they're not true, the impact on my client is manifest. And given that... In this case, what I'm trying to segue into is the segment of negligence that has to do with a given individual's right to be informed that he's not actually being represented by an attorney. The test for that is whether a reasonable person would have reason to believe that that he is being represented by the person who should have told him. Now, part of the grounds for my client believing that is you've got Robert Greenberg apparently working exclusively for Barron and Budd, making these statements about being...
I think the case law says that the conduct that generates the belief on the part of the client that they are being represented has to come from the lawyer that they think is representing them. The words can't come from a third party. Barron and Budd can't go around just telling everyone, we don't represent you, we don't represent you, we don't represent you, and just spinning around in a circle. The conduct has got to be by Barron and Budd that would lead a reasonable person to believe that Barron and Budd is representing them. Then there may arise a duty to say, on Barron and Budd, to say, no, we are not representing you in this matter or regarding this issue or in this context, or our representation is limited in this fashion. But I'm not aware of any case law that indicates that a third party can generate, by their conduct, a duty on a different lawyer to say, we're not representing you. I mean, give me a case that says that.
Well, in this particular case, it's not just Greenberg's conduct that's in question. When Fred Barron recommends Greenberg to Roger Parsons, he says, Greenberg's an excellent lawyer for this case. He's my lawyer, okay? And the meaning to take away from that is that he's the firm's lawyer and he does work for Fred Barron as well. And when you look at the connections between the lawyers that are in play here, it's really quite amazing.
Use that the other way, too, and say, well, Barron and Budd discharged any obligation they had to the highest degree by not referring Mr. Parsons to just any random lawyer, but to some lawyer that they actually thought so highly of that lawyer represented their firm. I mean, to refer to anybody else that they weren't willing to use themselves could be considered. I mean, I'm just not seeing how that...
Greenberg worked for them as a defendant's lawyer. And what we're talking about is Roger Parsons needs a plaintiff's lawyer to go after a gentleman who's notoriously hard to serve, notoriously hard to come to terms with. Wendell Turley, he's got his own building on the side of 75. I think it's apparent from the way things unfolded that Barron and Budd's relationship with Greenberg, I mean, they should have known. They should have known that he was an inappropriate referral, and it's apparent that the conflict of interest that you want to get some work for Robert Greenberg is actually playing a greater role here than providing a decent referral for Roger Parsons.
Counsel, your time is up. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your arguments. Your case is submitted.